We plant the food, we drive the cab, we load the ship, we run the lab, we build the bridges, we fly the plane, we do the work, this is our day,
we do the work.
This is the Labor Exchange on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Robert Lindgren, with the Colorado AFL-CIO and Denver Newspaper Guild. Our conversation today is with Colorado AFL-CIO President Josette Jaramillo, and we're going to be talking about her work as a social worker in Pueblo County, her local Ask Me 1335, and she also served as host last episode and will in the future. So, Josette, I am going to start off with the classic Terry Gross from NPR's Fresh Air question. Tell me about yourself.
Well, my name is Josette Jaramillo. I am a lifelong resident of Pueblo, Colorado. I love Pueblo. I know a lot of people complain about it, but I love it down here. I love the people. I love the community. I don't always love the weather because now it's getting hotter, but it's a great place to live. My dad was a mechanic. My mom is a barber. Anybody who's ever seen me at a convention with the fresh haircut knows that that is my mom's number one priority for me, is to make sure that my hair always looks nice. My grandfather was a steelworker and member of United Steelworkers Local 2102. My grandmother was a stay-at-home mom. That's on my dad's side. On my mom's side, my grandma also was a stay-at-home mom, but growing up worked in the fields. My grandfather, so my mom's dad, worked. He actually used to work at the cemetery. And then after that, he worked for the state at the parks department. So he worked at Swim Beach at the reservoir. So that's kind of who we are as Jaramillos and Mondragons. My family comes from New Mexico in the Las Vegas Mora area.
Well, and I like that I, you know, asked you to tell me about yourself, and you know, your family is so much a part of you and their history, and that having lived in Pueblo, you know, I think back to how it was so important to my family the few years, about four years that we lived there, just growing closer together, being able, my wife did stay at home at that time, and having that time when our kids were really young. And that's one of the really positive things I see in Pueblo from just my short time there. And just the tight-knit community. And I not to go too deep into my own views on Pueblo, but I'm thinking about how, like, when you're at a festival or you're walking somewhere and people just stop, all of a sudden, huge groups of people just stop. And I realized it really annoyed me at first. And then I realized it's because they all knew each other and were, you know, having this little slice of community. And I don't see that as much always in the Denver metro area. So you work for Pueblo County. What kind of work do you do for the citizens of Pueblo?
Yeah, so I have worked for Pueblo County Department of Human Services for the last almost 17 years. July 5th will be 17 years for me. So I work in child welfare. I am currently the supervisor of the Family Resource Unit. So my unit does a lot of different things. We do foster care licensing and certification, which also includes like lots of foster parent outreach and recruitment. So we're doing like lots of festivals and lots of things that are occurring on the weekends. So we do that. We also do kinship care. So anytime a kiddo comes into care and is in the home of a relative, a neighbor, a family friend, we consider that all kinship care. We actually assign a caseworker to those cases, and they are there primarily to support that kinship family member, to help with resources, to kind of guide them through how our system works. We do that. We also handle all of the interstate cases. So anytime we need to place a kiddo out of state, or another state is requesting to place a kiddo within Pueblo County, we get all of those requests. So we have to go out and do like either a home evaluation or a full home study on those providers. We also do diligent search and family finding. So whenever we have a kid who goes into foster care, our job is to find family members. So we do a really deep dive on social media. We have access to some other programs that we can pull up information. So we're trying to find family members to get kids out of foster care, which seems a little counterproductive on the other end, because we, you know, have foster homes, but we're also trying to get rid of foster homes. So we do it all. It's a lot. And then on my end, it's a lot of supervision. It's a lot of paperwork. It's report writing, because, you know, we answer to Colorado Department of Human Services.
What's the hardest part about your job?
The hardest part about my job is that I work in a system that protects children, but unfortunately, we're protecting them from another caregiver or whatever that kind of looks like. So we see a lot of trauma. I have personally seen a lot of kids who have been really hurt by their providers and by their parents. Sometimes that happens to be a foster parent. You know, there's no immunity for foster parents or for folks who are really wealthy or folks of a certain race. I mean, we see it all through all socioeconomic statuses, but the hardest part is kind of carrying those stories with you when you are just kind of doing everyday things. And it's really challenging work, but it can also be really rewarding.
Yeah, it would seem to be that kind of job that you'd really have to, maybe like teaching or some other professions where there's a certain, I'm not going to say honor, but a certain responsibility that you feel. Do you find that to be the case?
Absolutely. I my job right now, I have to review the home studies of non-relative foster parents. And I keep in mind what my previous supervisor said is that we're licensing strangers to take care of really vulnerable kids. And if you always look at them as strangers, then you have kind of a heightened awareness, and you really need to be very thorough when you're reading about their history. Is there anything that kind of causes you concern? We're not looking for perfect families. Those are the ones that I find most suspicious. The ones that I think do some of the best work are those foster families who have really kind of been through it and really want to give back. So, you know, those are the kind of things I think that I really look for, but I take my job really personally. I think people who know me in like a social sense say, you know, she doesn't take anything serious, because I joke around a lot. And, you know, on the stage at conventions, I'm telling jokes and kind of laughing. And, you know, that is a big part of my personality. But I do take my job very seriously and really want to make sure that we're doing the best job we can when we're licensing these strangers to take care of kids.
You know, I wasn't actually thinking I would bring this up at my own personal experience here, but I for a short while was in foster care, and a lot of the things you talked about sound very similar in that the strangers that took care of me in like maybe the most, you know, timely manner, needing someone who can directly provide shelter, then living with family members, in my case, my grandparents, and ultimately going back to live with my mom and my stepdad when they were really in a great place to give me the life that they wanted to. So yeah, it's humbling to think the type of person that has to do that work and the type of person who has to have, you know, a lot of really hard skills too. So I guess maybe I want to ask you a little bit too about the type of schooling that you have to take and what that's meant for you in your life.
Oh, so honestly, I was not a great student in high school or in undergraduate school. I think I've always been really smart, but I never really applied myself. Like I said, I always just kind of go through life with this like, attitude. So, you know, I did well. I didn't apply myself. I didn't study super hard. I went into kind of the humanities because I really had an interest in criminal justice. One of my favorite classes in undergrad was taking like the multiple murders case. So it was all about serial killers and spree killers. And I thought it was fascinating. It was one of my favorite classes. And I just applied for a ton of jobs. I probably still have this little notebook in one of my little bins of all my personal stuff, of all the different applications that I put in after I graduated school. And I got hired at Parkview as a bedside sitter. So essentially my job was trying not to fall asleep throughout the night, but also make sure that patients who were on suicide watch or fall risk, or, you know, folks who were pulling out their hoses or their IVs, didn't do that. That was my entire job. And I did graveyard shift and I loved it. I still say that 17 years later, I still have not quite adjusted to day shift, but I've always been kind of a night owl. So from there, I went and worked at the community mental health center in the inpatient unit, working with folks who, whether they needed an adjustment to their meds or they were stepping down from a higher level of care like CMHIP. I worked at, it was called Spanish Peaks Mental Health Center in the, what was it called? The ATU, the acute treatment unit. So I did that for about a year, maybe a year and a half. And I was just kind of as needed. I mean, I always got about 36 to 38 hours a week, but I didn't have any benefits. I really didn't know what benefits meant. I didn't have health insurance or dental insurance growing up. So I didn't really know what that meant, but I knew it was important. And I wanted something where I could have like a guaranteed schedule and a guaranteed paycheck. So I applied at Department of Human Services. I had no idea what the job entailed. One of these days, I'll tell you about, you know, what happened right before my interview, because it's a funny story. But I think they liked me and I got the job. I had no idea what I was doing and just kind of fell into it that way and really enjoyed the work that I did in the community. I enjoyed the work that I did with families and I enjoyed the work that I do with the union. I think I was born to be a helper, and working at social services and then kind of being, you know, president of the local and helping out my coworkers, they kind of go hand in hand for me and really is a way to kind of use some of those skills that I've developed over the years.
Yeah. What made you decide to take on a leadership role within your union?
I think it just happened by accident, honestly. Maybe there's no accidents, but somebody handed me a flyer that said, you know, we're hiring canvassers at $15 an hour. So I said, oh, okay, I'll do it. So I interviewed with Sean Hinga, and I had no idea what canvassing meant. So I said, well, I'll do it. I need the money. Turns out I loved it. I loved knocking on doors. I loved talking to my neighbors. I loved talking about the elected officials that I had met, because I wasn't really politically active, but now I knew the people that we were talking about. It was the first time that I met Angela Giron, because she was the wife of Steve Naraki, and we were canvassing for Steve Naraki at the time. And I think I just kind of really took to it, and it was just kind of a natural fit. So I started going to our local union meetings, and you know, they needed somebody to sit on elections committee. So, of course, I raised my hand and I roped in one of my coworkers. She still sits on my executive board. And then they had vacancies on the executive board. So, you know, we raised our hands and said, yeah, we'll do it. And then at the end of that first term, the president said she wasn't going to run again. So I was like, I guess I'll do it. I'd like nominated myself and did that first year. And I guess the rest is history. I've been here ever since.
Well, and that's interesting to me, because I was living in Pueblo at that time. That was a city council race. And you mentioned Sean Hinga. He's someone who works with AFSCME as a political person. And it was an effort to try to make a difference down there. And yeah, what an interesting way to get involved. And, you know, you mentioned a little bit of this, but why do you think it's important for you to have a union and for your coworkers at the county to have a union?
So we deal with some really challenging stuff at work, and not just in child welfare, even in assistance payments and child support. We're not always everybody's favorite people, especially, you know, during COVID when we were trying to figure out how to deliver services to the community and also keep ourselves safe. So it's really important just to be able to have that outlet where you can join with 20 other caseworkers or 20 other assistance payments workers and talk about the issues that are happening on the job. So it really is a vehicle to bring those issues up to our department director, our county manager, our board of county commissioners, and really talk about what's happening on the front lines or in the trenches, as they say, because most of our elected officials have never worked at social services. They've never been a caseworker. They've never worked in assistance payments. I think many of them don't even know what we make. And what we make on paper looks good and dandy, but what we bring home is another story, because you got to pay for, you know, insurance and benefits and taxes and all of that good stuff. So it has been really, really important, I think, to make sure that things are done fairly and that things are done safely, because we really do deal with some very dangerous people, some very aggressive people sometimes. So having that vehicle to talk about what those issues are has been really important.
You hinted to this in some of your answer. What are some of the other roles and work that your coworkers do in the county, or your members and you know, fellow folks?
So we have all of the Department of Human Services under the umbrella of Local 1335, and that includes our folks who do weatherization. So they go into homes and they'll inspect furnaces. They install evaporative coolers. They approve folks for, you know, new energy efficient refrigerators if they need them. We also have commodities. So those folks work in a warehouse and they do food distribution for our low income and elderly community members. We also have assistance payments. So they do SNAP benefits. They do Medicaid. They do TANF. We have case managers who also do that. And then they provide kind of job readiness stuff for some of our community members. We have child support. So that's a little self-explanatory, but a lot goes into child support. They got to deal with court and establishing court orders and, you know, making sure that folks are staying current on those payments for kids who aren't in their direct care, at least not full time. So they do that. We also have adult protection. So adult protection, like child protection, they're making sure that our elderly neighbors are safe and not being taken advantage of. We have single entry point. They also work with our elderly population, and there are case managers who are working with some of our elderly patients and elderly neighbors who need services, whether it's a nursing home or in-home care. They're working to help them get established in those programs. We have child welfare, and child welfare deals with kiddos from age 0 all the way up to 21. In that, we also have a visitation center at our facility. So we do visits for parents who do not have custody of their kids currently. We also have an adoption unit. We do foster care. And then we have our crisis and intake folks. So they take calls from community members who are concerned about kids 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if something happens and there's an emergency in the middle of the night, our crisis folks are out there picking up kiddos and either, you know, transporting them to a relative's home or looking for foster care placements. I also deal with some of those cases in the middle of the night when they need a foster home. So I will call, you know, some of our providers and say like, hey, can you take this kiddo for the weekend? We have a couple of emergency homes who are willing to take some teens and some pretty difficult teens. So we do a lot under our umbrella.
Well, yeah, and I think in addition to some of the direct crisis intervention stuff you mentioned, like at the very beginning, you mentioned evaporative coolers and access to that. And, you know, I've been through several Pueblo summers, and having access to something that can keep you cool during those hottest months when it is consistently over 110 degrees for sometimes days on end, that saves lives. And you think about some of the ways that the barrier to entry is high, but then actually operating those, it's a fan and a drip and something that works incredibly well in Pueblo's climate. So what a benefit to the community to have someone who's thinking about these things and trying to get those in to people.
Yeah, I also forgot to mention our energy assistance program. Jenny would punch me in the arm if I forgot to mention her program, and that's LEAP. And so they help with heating costs over the winter. So they're a 6-month program, and they do all of the eligibility and distribution of those benefits, and they pay them directly to their natural gas provider or their electric provider if they have electric heat. So make sure people stay warm during the winter. And we do a lot of outreach with that program because, you know, we're recruiting foster parents and they're getting the word out about their programs. So we're doing both of those programs and recruitment and outreach for those together. So yeah, and you never realize how much you need an evaporative cooler until you don't have one, because it gets up into the hundreds and it can be a little humidish down here because we have the reservoir. I just put my cooler in the window because I'm a hot body and I need to stay cool at least during the night, or I won't sleep and then I will be very grumpy.
Yeah, well, and it just does remind you of the crisis in Chicago in the 90s when there wasn't an access to some of the cooling aspects during a heat wave, and it did cause, you know, major problems. Thinking to the work of county workers, you know, in your community, what are some things that you don't think the public understands or you'd like them to understand about the work that you and your coworkers do?
I think that the public doesn't understand that sometimes our hands are tied by regulations by the state, you know, in terms of who gets benefits, who doesn't, how we kind of determine the eligibility for that. Same thing with child support. I think they also don't understand that as caseworkers, we're also bound by the court and by regulations by Colorado Department of Human Services, which kind of trickles down from the legislature, as well as the Colorado Children's Code, which is, you know, a book that's about this thick of all the laws and stuff that govern child welfare. And then we're also governed by federal rules because our funding comes, you know, from the feds and from the state. We're actually 80-20 funded, most of us. And some of us are 100% funded by the state. So the county chips in 20% of our wages, where the state pays 80%. I think it's also important for people to know that we're in the same exact homes that our police officers and sheriff's officers are in. The difference is most of the time we're equipped with our padfolio, and that's about it, and a cell phone. So there are some pretty dangerous situations that we can get into as caseworkers and child welfare. I don't think that we have a great reputation in the community, and I think that it's the nature of the work that we do. You're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't in our area. But it is a pretty serious business, I think, when you're removing children from their parents. But it's always with cause. You know, we don't get to make those decisions by ourselves. They have to go through, you know, the court, and it becomes a court order. So I don't think that people really understand how many rules and regulations and stuff we have to deal with and kind of know about off the top of our head.
Your hometown, Pueblo, Colorado, deep union history. What is that union history or that union connection meant for you and your family?
I didn't realize this really early on. You know, when you would talk to me as a young worker, you know, at 23, I just started at the department, and, you know, we had a union, and I was like, oh, this is cool. I don't know what it means, but I know that it's cool. Which to me says that, you know, my parents did something right, you know, raising me, that I knew that being in a union was really cool. And it wasn't until I started really thinking about how many of my family members were union workers that I started really understanding the significance of that. So two of my uncles are retired union butchers, one from Safeway, one from King Soopers. My godfather, my Nino, was a steelworker and a member of United Steelworkers Local 2102 at Evraz. It was a CF&I back then, and he actually was part of the strike. He didn't return to the mill. He went to work for the state after that. And then, you know, talking about my grandpa, I always knew he worked at the mill, but it never occurred to me that he was a union member. So a couple of years ago, I actually went and I lived with my aunt for about 5 or 6 years in my grandparents' old home, which was really nice to kind of reconnect and rediscover my family history and my roots. And what my aunt actually gave me is, you know, something that is very precious to me. So for my grandfather's 25th anniversary, they gave him a CF&I pin, and it had a little ruby in it. So my grandpa gave that pin to the kids and said, you know, my aunts and uncles and my dad, and said, you know, a lot of the guys are turning this into a ring. So all of my aunts and uncles and my dad kind of pitched in, and they had his pin made into a ring. And that ring is actually now in my possession. It belonged to my grandfather. It will never, ever fit me because my grandfather had these huge hands. I have big hands for a lady. My dad has big hands, but my grandfather's hands were huge. I mean, I put a spacer on it and it doesn't even fit on my thumb. So that's how big this man's hands were, and he wore it on his ring finger. So I think a lot of people who have grown up and were born and raised in Pueblo have similar stories. Just about everybody has a connection to the mill. That was one of the biggest employers back then. And everybody in Pueblo has like that connection when you sit down and talk to them. Oh yeah, you know, my dad was a teacher, or my uncle used to work for Board of Waterworks, or, you know, my Nino used to work at the mill. So it very much is a union town.
I think that's a good spot to end our conversation. And thank you so much for being on the Labor Exchange today.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me. It's fun to sit on the other side of the microphone where I just get to talk about who I am and answer the questions that you have prepared for me. So thanks for having me on.
Oh, and I can't wait to get you back in the host seat, because you did an amazing job at the last episode. Anyone who's listening should go into the archives and listen to President Jaramillo's conversation with Liz Schuler, president of the AFL-CIO. This has been the Labor Exchange on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. We are a member of the Labor Radio Network. Check out more great labor conversations at laborradionetwork.org. I'm your host today, Robert Lindgren, and we've been talking with Josette Jaramillo, a social worker and president of the AFL-CIO and AFSCME Local 1335. Have a great day.
And it's go, boys, go. They'll time your every breath. And every day you're in this place, you're 2 days nearer death.
But you go. Well, I process man of my, and I'm telling you no lie. I work and breathe among the fumes that trail across the sky.
There's thunder all around me, and there's poison in the air. There's a lousy smell that smacks of hell and dust all in the air.
And it's go, boys, go.
They'll time your every breath. And every day you're in this place, you're 2 days nearer death.
But you go. Well, I've worked among the spinners, and I breathe the oily smoke.
I've shoveled up the gypsum, and it nigh on made you choke. I've stood knee deep in cyanide, got sick with a caustic burn. Been working a rough fight scene enough to make your stomach turn.
And it's go, boys, go.
They'll time your every breath. And every day you're in this place, you're 2 days nearer death.
But you go. There's overtime and bonus opportunities galore.
The young men like their money and they all come back for more. But soon you're knocking on and you look older than you should. For every bob made on the job, you pay with flesh and blood.
And it's go, boys, go.
They'll time your every breath. And every day you're in this place, you're 2 days nearer death.
But you go. Well, I process man of mine, and I'm telling you no lie. I work and breathe among the fumes that trail across the sky.
There's thunder all around me, and there's poison in the air. There's a lousy smell that smacks of hell and dust all in me hair.
And it's go, boys, go.
They'll time your every breath. And every day you're in this place, you're 2 days nearer death.
And it's go, boys, go.
They'll time your every breath. And every day you're in this place, you're 2 days nearer death.
But you go.